Well, here we are again after I just finished. So I think the best we can make the most of it if we make this one gigantic 30-minute conversation, as opposed to me being a talking head. Now, of course, you could argue, oh, yes, but you're a professor who lectures all the time, and we know what happens. You just start talking, and then it keeps going. And then there's 5 minutes left. He said we would have time for conversation, and then we didn't. So.
Can we start with a question?
Yes.
The title has a huge assumption.
Yes.
And that is that we are a cultural minority.
Ah, that's why I was saying about, hey, where'd that cake come from? I'm sorry.
Hey, Sarah, you want some?
I'm sorry, that'd be great. Hey, wait a second. I can't answer this question.
I can't answer this question because
it's being recorded. Let's go with the phone. Which one of these am I going to pick? Okay.
In this case, there actually is a word.
Yeah. But so that's why when I was talking about the question of power and how much power we have, and why I would say the piece about, or the things about, the fact that we still have the possibility in the United States to be people who participate in the structures of society. Not just because by voting, but in fact, actually, people, because we tend to think of politics, and maybe this is just because of the media, you know, but we tend to think of politics in terms of national politics, not in terms of local politics. The ways people could even participate at the more local level, and differences that could even make where they live. I think the fact is that you can actually do something. You can actually be on the school board. You can actually, run for mayor. I mean, it's not something that only other people do. So we have those possibilities. There are possibilities because when people are involved in business, they introduce products, introduction of these products or the use of those products, sometimes themselves or the use of them are very influential in the ways that our society may go one direction or another. So we're not shut out of those things. It is true that we're in a much more morally complex and in some ways morally chaotic circumstance, you could argue that in some ways it's what was subterranean in the 1950s going nuclear. And the reason I say 1950s is because, if your vision of the 1950s is the Donna Reed Show, Father Knows Best, Leave It to Beaver, even Happy Days, we think of it as this sort of idyllic time where what I always like to say when people talk about the 60s is that you realize that the people that went crazy in the 60s were children in the 50s. So what was happening? Thank you.
No, this will not be seen which one he chooses on the recorder. So make sure that someone makes an observation when he does, so that it does make it onto the recorder.
I have in front of me two pieces of cake. One piece is lighter. One piece is chocolate. Which piece will I pick?
Set yourself up.
I know. Right, exactly. Well, I may actually, the reason I mentioned the 50s is because people often point to the 60s, but people didn't just spring up out of nowhere in the 1960s. They grew up in a context of post-World War II, civil religion in the United States, where there's lots of church attendance, etc., but people said there's no there for a lot of what was going on in their homes. Well, you don't even really believe this or whatever, so why should I believe it? Then they, then you get that trajectory of people that went, because it wasn't everybody, but it was enough of them, that gives you, just to be symbolic, gives you Woodstock, let's say. So, and of course, what happens there is a strong emphasis on, if you tie that into what happens with the 1970s being the Me Generation, you have the trajectory of a society, you know, with lots of ebbs and flows, where we do make the satisfaction of the self the highest good among all things. And the way that that works out, if we, let's use just like, you know, the hot button moral issue right now, you know, homosexuality. The reason why lots of younger evangelicals and sometimes not, you know, older evangelicals don't know what to do on this is because one of the greatest sins in society is to make anybody feel bad about anything. Mm-hmm. Because if they feel bad about something, if they're being denied something, then there's something about their self-expression, self-actualization, their participation, etc., that has been violated. So there's, it's almost as if there's a moral claim being made that it's immoral to prevent anyone from having what they deem as their personal satisfaction. So that creates a kind of moral anarchy because everybody gets to decide what is their moral satisfaction. And unless it's a gigantic outlier, then people don't tend not to push against that. And so,
and what would be a gigantic outlier today?
Well, I mean, honestly, in spite of what Richard Dawkins said, pedophilia is still an outlier. I mean, that's why pedophiles go to jail. I mean, they had to be isolated because other inmates would kill them. Because it's like, children, are you serious?
But I mean, academia is, you know, Peter Singer is, yes, saying that bestiality.
Yes. Well, but even though he's been influential, I don't think his views aren't mainstream. But there are people who are influenced by that. And I do think what that can reflect, though, is I was talking to Dennis Hollinger about this in October. And he said that, you know, one of the biggest problems is that if we think that everything is sort of up for grabs in terms of how we all assess what the choices that people make. And by up for grabs, I mean, there's really nothing guiding us to discern how to make good or ill out of the choices that people make. It's because, you know, if someone says, well, what makes something good? Well, in the broader society, the fact that there's some moral standard external to us that says what is good or ill, that's not the way most people are tending to think. Now, of course, this is why it's in some ways truly postmodern. There are ways that people respond to things with outrage about something being unjust that suggests that they do believe that there's a moral standard.
Right.
But that's not done consistently. It's not done consistently. So, I mean, I think the toughest thing is that, well, I guess two things that I think contribute to us sort of having sort of moral minority status, or at least the experience of it. Pluralism's one, but the other is, if we say that Christians began re-engaging society, if you go with the narrative, the fundamentalist modernist controversy, fundamentalist before fundamentalist meant militant anti-intellectual fundamentalist, when it just meant you believe about the Bible, the virgin birth, scripture, the resurrection, things like that, just the fundamentals of the faith. Well, those people lost in the mainline denominations and separate out, and certainly, you know, many of them circle the wagons, create their own world, withdraw from society, while still, I mean, still they still vote. But they would never be involved in politics, for example. They would draw from society, and hope for some kind of, you know, American civil war religion type thing, but they're not going to run for office or try to do anything about it. That withdrawal, eventually you get the re-engagement, mid-late 70s, let's say, however one wants to talk about how that emerged. by, I think, for some reason, I think 1998. I don't know why 98, but around 98, 99, you start hearing a broad range of evangelicals talking about holistic engagement. And it's not a question about whether or not social action should be part of what Christians do. Whereas when I was at Trinity in 1990, it was still a question. I mean, you could read about it being a question. I mean, in magazines or in journals, etc. So even though you have Lausanne, you know, the statement there, that wasn't, you know, accepted by everybody. There's a lot of people who's like, oh, I'm not so sure about that. By 98, people are thinking, oh, social engagement, political engagement, cultural engagement, all this stuff we ought to do. Bush gets elected, has a bunch of evangelicals in the White House. Iraq War happens. People start to care a little bit about the environment. Things don't work out so neatly, a lot because of the Iraq War, I think. By 2008, you have lots of evangelicals having a buyer's remorse about public engagement, and they're not sure what to do about it. And what's also happening is there are things, you know, evangelicals start to lose some kind of cultural influence. That, in particularly on issues like sexuality, I say in part because of a great strategy by the homosexual lobbies. If you've ever read the book After the Ball, that will tell you why. Because it's basically a public relations strategy. I mean, that's basically why I think that's. I mean, it's a PR thing. Brilliant.
Hollywood.
Yes, but I mean, that's Hollywood being part of the public relations strategy. I mean, Will and Grace and Modern Family have done a lot to normalize homosexuality. And it's important to say this, by the way. They're really good shows. They're really well done. That's why they stayed on the air a long time, why Ellen's show didn't, right? Because it wasn't really well written. So, but what happens with those things then is people start to see that even though evangelicals wanted to have this big re-engagement, the posture of evangelicals had, you know, for many had this culture war sort of thing attached to it, and this aura of being not so nice people. Not necessarily as bad.
He became a caricature,
but I think for some people, James Dobson represented it more broadly. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is you even have evangelicals like, I'm not so sure that if we're going to be involved in the public, we should be talking this way. And can't we just be more loving? And you have younger people who come along who want to be more loving. And then, of course, because of what happens, for, you know, sexuality for various reasons, more of them know people, even though you know, the actual numbers are 3.5% of the population is LGBTQ. Okay, that's, and those are from the Williams Institute, a gay think tank, okay? So the numbers have been basically consistent. But people, more people know someone who talks about that. And they don't know what to do because their assumption is, in part because of what the cultural rhetoric has been, but in part because they've seen bad things happen within their churches to people who identified as homosexual, they don't know how to hold truth and compassion together. And many of them would just rather err on the side of compassion than truth. Because nobody, who wants to be a hater? Right? So, I mean, I think, and part of what that does, though, that contributes to being in society with a moral compass where you don't think about, well, what's the wise way to hold to truth and express truth and express truth with love, etc. So that feeds into the broader erosion of a moral standard or a moral standard that you think you could hold everyone to. Because so many people just say, oh, we can't expect everybody to believe what we believe. So even if I believe this, it's what I believe. I don't know that I should try to make anybody else believe that. So then you get this circumstance that we're in, and there's a greater, right now there's a greater, there are trajectories of greater influence of other prevailing views of morality that aren't Christian, I would say.
I want to put my question in a context, if I can, and I'll put forth a couple of assumptions.
Okay.
And you correct me if you think my assumptions are wrong.
Okay.
Okay.
Feel free to.
Eat your cake. So, no, see, yeah. See, I was just gonna silently do it. See.
One of the things that you mentioned about the minority experience is lack of power.
Right.
And I believe that in America, one of the greatest expressions of lack of power is economic. One of the places where you would say, or I would assume, that we would have to look at America and say, yes, we still have a race problem, is the reality of a great many, perhaps even the majority of minorities would be in a lower economic class.
There's a greater percentage. Yes. But you do have an African American middle class, which you didn't have.
So. Yeah, and so in terms of the power, the feeling of enfranchisement or disenfranchisement based upon my perceived self wealth. If the direction of Christianity is to become more a minority, then it is likely that some of the first expressions of that will be to disempower economically Christians. The question is, what do you think, given the current state of evangelicalism, what do you think the response of the church will be when they find themselves disempowered economically?
Well, the first part, it's important to note this. In the same interview with Henry Louis Gates, who, if you don't know who he is, he teaches at Harvard. He runs African American Studies program there. And he was quoting someone who I can't remember, but he said that what the civil rights movement did successfully was facilitate the creation of a black middle class. But he said perhaps what it didn't do though was, I mean, it had this moral strength to it, but it didn't have an economic strategy. In other words, the civil rights movement didn't do anything about black poverty. Yeah. So, and I think that's one of the things that I think you saw later in Martin Luther King's life. Well, I mean, it was like, he wasn't near the end of his life. Okay. He was thinking class as well as race. Because really, the issue isn't really just black poverty. I mean, if you go to rural Appalachia, which is, in my view, is essentially off the radar for most Americans. Yeah. And people in Appalachia may as well not even exist. Or the people that live in the South, you know, I've had a student from Wheaton, she came from this area where all the girls go to high school, marry a guy who works in an oil rig. The idea of going to college the fact that she went to college was like, why are you going to college?
Yeah.
Right? And these aren't black, I mean, this is white,
yeah.
Southern girls, right? So I think it's a class piece and not just race. Yeah. That's why it's all complicated. Because you have wealthy African Americans, at least, even during slavery, you had some wealthy free African Americans. Obviously very few. But I think one of the reasons why the racial discrimination worked the way that it did. Yes, it had the perception issue about I'm white, you're black, or I'm white, and I'm white, you're Irish, you know, had all these things. While that was true, key to its expression was giving economic advantage to those who are the right kind of people, and disadvantage or lack of access to those who weren't. So, you know, sometimes people pit W.E.B. Du Bois against Booker T. Washington. Booker T. Washington's like, look, let's just make the most of it. Please serve all your bootstraps. Be industrious. Work hard, etc. Du Bois, who, of course, was this sort of patrician kind of, you know, intellectual, talented 10th guy. So this wasn't somebody who thought everybody was equal. But he thought that it shouldn't be just make the most. He wanted to, I think, somehow overcome this double consciousness that he had to live with, for example. So, and the reason I just mentioned them is that there's the question in the United States when people talk about this: how do you deal with the lack of the those who are economically down here? Well, shouldn't you just be industrious, etc.? And if you work hard, you'll be a success. And people will point to examples. What I always like to say about those examples is the reason you talk about those examples is because they're exceptional, not because they're typical.
Yeah.
And the thing is, they're exceptional across races. Because there are even people who are middle class who've done everything that people say you should do, get an education, work hard, don't be honest, etc. And it's gone just from one like business failure to another. And it's not because, and it has nothing to do with whether they're good people or whether they have integrity or whether they even had a good idea. It just didn't work out for them, right? And the only reason I say that is there's the whole question of what really enables people to succeed economically, and there are a lot of factors involved in that, education being a big one, and certainly the segregation of education, big part of that, and I think still that's reverberating. So, but when it comes to Christians as a more minority, I'm not sure that I agree that Christians that to be Christian is to expect being economically disenfranchised.
I wouldn't expect that to happen for years.
Okay, so
I would say, so I believe that there is a cultural subconscious.
Okay.
That will not hire the different than me, and when the culture as a whole gets so secular that the Christian who is open about their Christianity walks in for a job and they won't get it as a result.
Right.
Then, like, Tim gradually, Tebow. What's that? Like Tim Tebow?
Sorry, I'm not sure.
Sorry about that. I'm just blabbering. But I'm sure that you probably have friends who recognize I went and applied for that job. I was fully qualified for it. I didn't get it because I'm black. And
thankfully, not many, but yeah.
But that still happens.
Yes.
We know it does. And especially in a depressed economic time where there's lots of selection. My personal feeling is that within the church, I don't know that we're mentally equipped because there's a certain dependency in poverty.
There can be, yes.
Well,
yes. The only reason I'm saying that is because, yes, you can create, a welfare mentality, we'll call it, right? Well, yes, there's no question about
that. And I'm not saying that everybody that's in poverty have a welfare mentality.
But one of the challenges of dealing with poverty is how do you make addressing poverty about empowerment as opposed to creating a cycle of dependency?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I completely agree with that. I think the tricky thing is there are two things. One is I think it is possible that you could have people getting shut out from positions of power and the kind of influence I said that could happen. That they could happen now. It may not. That may not 20, 30 years from now be the case. I think the other side of it, though, interestingly, though, is even within churches, though, people that are really good at business and the kind of people that they just stumble and they make money anyway. Mm-hmm. I mean, because there's some of those people. I mean, they just, they breathe and, you know, they're wealthy. I mean, it just happens.
Yeah.
Well, those people, I don't think are well served by the churches that they're in very often. I think they're marginalized by those churches. So they're not equipped to know how to think about what I do with the fact that I'm good at making money.
Yeah.
Should I feel just bad about it? It's like, look, you wouldn't be good at making money, okay, just because you went out in the woods and made a pentagram and lit it on fire or something, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's because God gifted you.
Yeah.
And you're in a context where you're able to flourish with this. I mean, someone like a Michael Milken, that's why the guy made so much money, because he sees things other people don't see, and his mind's incredible. So those people in our churches need to be encouraged to be wise with their wealth, but also affirmed in the fact that, look, what you do matters to God.
Mm-hmm.
And what you do all the way through whatever is going on in your business, and not just the fact that you make a lot of money, but the culture you create in your company and all those things. Churches need to attend to that. Cause I think business people often feel like, I show up and I know they like my money, but I don't know that. But I don't get equipped to think Christianly about being an executive. So I think though that dimension of it has to happen as well. So the people that are already in places of influence can actually consider how being Christian makes a difference in that, as opposed to just being good at what they do and just kind of going with the rules of the game with their peers, but not really being influenced by their Christian formation. So to me, I think that's a huge thing that needs to happen.
So. Seems like we're focusing on the issue.
We have 4 minutes, unfortunately.
Yeah, Christianity is a minority, but I'd rather talk about real racism, which...
We can talk about that, too.
We have that thing out now, and I'm not sure that Christians are going to be a minority, at least not anytime soon. Let me ask you a personal question about racism. You're a black guy. We invited you here to talk about racism. Would you have preferred to be invited to talk about Kuiper?
The other Father Abraham?
Yeah, the other Father Abraham. I had a friend who did all of his dissertations on Kuiper.
Oh, really? Who's this?
Glenn Reynolds at Calvin.
Okay.
He's the head librarian.
Oh, okay.
We would give him a rough time about, you know, what's next? Kuiper's dog, Kuiper's cookie, to get all the praise. But, so, I mean, we're still racist.
There's still a lot of trans stuff with Kuiper stuff to be translated.
Yeah, there's good stuff.
So...
does that bother you?
Well, I'm glad you asked.
Would you embrace that role, or would you rather say, I'm a Kuiper guy?
Well, because I do get in, I do enough Kuiper stuff that it doesn't bother me. And actually, I mean, but I did think this through, though, because initially when I was at Trinity, I was like, all right, I want to be the person that everybody thinks you need to invite this guy to be the antithesis to James Cone, or, you know, the person who does the black thing, right? And so there's two ways to thought about it. One, you know, I'm going to just do this. I mean, I'm doing the Kuiper stuff because of my interest in culture engagement. So I talk about that stuff. And I've been invited to talk about that stuff. So I did. But it's also occurred to me that, also because, you know, I'm not the angry black man, you know. I mean, I'm not a person who is suspicious of whites, etc. I need to steward that in a way so that when I talk, so that I should talk about this. And that when I do, I can talk about it in a way, hopefully it helps people to see that we can do, there's hard stuff that we need to talk about and hard work we need to do. And there's this fact. I had to think about this being a professor at Wheaton. In certain circumstances, if I don't talk about these students, well, nobody's going to talk to them about it. And so it's not the only thing I talk about, but they need to be aware. I mean, for example, some students think there's no issues with race at Wheaton, which I have to say is, well, why don't you ask somebody, you know, of a darker pigmentation and come back and talk to me? And not just one of them. Ask a number of them. Because some people, they go to Wheaton, they have a great experience. They go, no, I don't have any race problems at all. Other people, it was so hard for me to be there. Mm-hmm. It was the hardest 4 years of my life. And because there's this breadth of experiences. And for some people, going through 4 years, when you feel like every day you are in a perpetual mode of explaining yourself to other people, I mean, that's emotionally exhausting. And when people say, we welcome you, but there seems to be an asterisk beside your welcome. Well, someone needs to talk to students and say, listen, just because you don't perceive a race problem, does it mean that there isn't one? And when you say there isn't one just because you don't see one, that's exerting power and saying, I've got the power to define whether there's a problem or not. And whether you say it or not doesn't matter because I got the power. So I need to say that to them so they can see that. And say, it doesn't mean everybody's got this problem, etc., but there's a complex thing we've got to deal with. And if we're going to be for Christ in His kingdom at Wheaton College, then we really ought to be pursuing what it means to be for Christ in His kingdom, including dealing with this, rather than saying, no, there's not one, because you don't see one. So, I mean, there's this thing called the form wall, which I hate reading, because students always say stuff that honestly, I'm not going to say anything else about it because I'm recording. But it makes me upset sometimes. So, but there was on the forum wall, someone had written something about a response to this group called Solidarity Deals with Race Stuff. And somebody said, Solidarity brings up problems that don't exist. And someone had underlined it and said, yeah, that's right. I mean, that set me off. Because it was this idea that, I mean, you don't have to like the way they talked about the problem. But to say they talk about problems don't exist presumes a level of knowledge about everything that's going on at Wheaton College that you couldn't possibly have. The presumption that you know every circumstance, every experience, to say that there's no problem. It's huge. I mean, but people can say that if they think, well, of course I can say that because what I see is reality. And I get to tell people who, you know, I get to say what's real and what's not because I'm used to doing that. All right. So anyway, so I, because I'm not more, you know, radical in this position or whatever, I think it's important for me to say that. But I had to get to that place where I was initially pushing against doing the black thing or whatever. It occurred to me that at one level, it's part of what I do with cultural engagement. This is one dimension of it that one has to talk about. Talk about it in its complexity. I mean, one of the reasons I said that it's an issue for everyone today is that it's easier to talk about it from a standpoint that there's been this victim oppressor thing. But what the reality is that even those who've been, you know, in the legacy of being victims or whatever, maybe they've never had no experience themselves, whatever, they still have stuff to deal with. And they might be angry. There's still stuff for them to deal with, too. There's a range of stuff that people have to deal with. It's not just one direction. It's multidirectional. Because if people are going to live as people who are really seeking the best for each other, loving their neighbor as themselves, it's not just a matter of the victimizer apologizing, the victim saying thank you, and then, you know, you sing kumbaya, because it's way more complex than that. And there's a lot of work that needs to go on in all of our lives for various things. So we've got to talk about it as this big, complex thing. But I had to go through a process, I think, to get to the place where I could talk about it like this. Well, it's 3:38. So what are we supposed to be doing now?
Now we go upstairs. There's a brief break here again, 3:45,
okay.
Or about. There are some breakout sessions or some seminars.
Okay, and this seminars. One's with the pastoral questions thing?
That comes next. Let me just give you the time.
Okay.
There are mini seminars from 3:45 to 4:30.
Okay.
And then we will break up into sessions again. I would like for all of us to meet in the main sanctuary worship center first. And we'll talk through some of these issues. And then you won't necessarily come back here. I'm going to divide us into fourths. So that it's, we'll, there will be a fourth of all the attendees down here. The point of the matter is so that there's evenly distributed numbers so that we can talk, share, pray. And Vincent will facilitate that. And it's more of a discussion about...
Facilitate one of them.
Excuse me?
Facilitate one of them.
Yes.
Right. Right.
So it's a matter of... So how are we thinking about these things? And what issues you're struggling with? So it's an attempt to...
You know, both pieces of cake are quite tasty.
Let me say this. Since I thought through this process of inviting Vincent, and he and I had a lot of very, I think, fruitful discussions about this, he's a systematic theologian. That's why he's asked. But he's African-American. That's also why he's asked. So if it were merely a systematic theologian, and he's dealing with, I think, a critical issue of racial issues, it wouldn't have worked to get a white guy or a white lady. It just wouldn't have worked. So there's also that reality. And so he and Vincent had good discussions about this. And he is he's a Kuyperian scholar. And in some ways, for example, we had Wesley Hill last year.
Not a slavish Kuyperian.
No, that's right.
I used to be. But now I can admit that he has clay feet. So that took a while.
That's right. So Wesley Hill, who do you bring in that struggles with same-sex attractions besides somebody who struggles with same-sex attractions? Yeah. And so there's this reality. And I also realize that there are differences of emotion, DNA, responses from an African-American perspective of the two centuries than it is a Hispanic. Mm-hmm. Or an Asian. Mm-hmm. Not that there are not some similarities, but there's
definitely distinctions. No questions about it.
So anyway, that was some of the process that we went through in thinking about it as well. Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.